When someone is trying to lie to you in a face-to-face exchange, you may be able to tell by their shifting eyes. But what if that deception comes in a text or email? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today we listen back to Ben Kiefer's conversation with Joey George, an Iowa State University professor who studies computer-mediated deception. Then a look at the Ames Laboratory and patents developed there. Ben's conversation with metallurgist Ivor Anderson, who has led a $40 million lead-free solder project. Join our conversation after the news.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Great to have you with us for this encore edition of the program. When someone's trying to lie to you in a face-to-face exchange, you may be able to tell by their shifting eyes, some fidgeting, or even perspiration. But what if that deception comes in text communication, online, and there are no physical cues to read? Therein lies the problem, according to my first guest today. Joey George is an Iowa State University professor of Management Information Systems. He's also the DeVries Chair in Business at Iowa State University's College of Business. Professor George, welcome. You have been studying something called computer-mediated deceptive communication for more than a decade. Start off by telling us what is meant by that term.
Well, there are really two parts to that. Increasingly now we communicate via computer-mediated modes of communication, which include everything from email to instant messaging to voice over IP to telepresence or video conferencing over something like Skype. The deceptive part comes into play when you think about normal communications, and by normal I mean face-to-face between two or more people. Normal communication is filled with things that are not always completely true, and there's no reason to believe that computer-mediated communication should be any different. We find that that's indeed the case, that people are just as likely to try to deceive you or to lie using computer-mediated communication modes as in typical face-to-face communication.
Okay, so tell us about the latest study here and what it revealed.
Well, I was actually part of a six-year study that was funded by the Air Force Office of Scientific Research. And as part of that, we did several different studies. But I guess the most current thing that we're focusing on right now actually has to do with computer-mediated communication and deception and cultural differences. We gave students a scenario by which they were asked to lie to their boss in a work situation. And half of the students were in People's Republic of China, and half of the students were in Florida, where I came from. And so we asked them to please choose a communication medium that they would be most comfortable with for lying in that situation. And one of the interesting things that we found was that there were some pretty key differences in the communication media that were chosen. The people in China, for example, far and away preferred face-to-face communication and didn't prefer the computer-mediated modes so much. American students were much more all over the board, although they still preferred face-to-face just by not as large margin. Another study that we did, we actually made some videotapes of students in the U.S. and also students in Spain. And we had a situation set up to where they had to enhance their resumes and then defend those enhancements to an interviewer that they didn't know. And then we asked the interviewer at the end whether or not he or she had seen anything dishonest. We actually then used the videotapes and we made what we call stimulus reels, of these same people being honest or dishonest. And we set it up so that we could also vary the media in the stimulus reels. So some of the snippets were full audiovisual video. Others were video only without sound. Others were sound only. And others were transcriptions of the text. And so then we took those stimulus reels, one in Spanish from the Spanish students, one in English from the American students, and we showed them to other students who had no association with these folks, didn't know them. And we played the stimulus reel in English for both American and Spanish students, and we played the stimulus reel in Spanish for Spanish students as well as American students. And one interesting thing we found, which supports a lot of the literature, is that people in one culture were better able to detect deception in those stimulus reels than they were for people in their own culture. In other words, the American students, for example, were better able to pick out the deceptions among the Spanish students than they were among the American students.
That doesn't make sense, does it?
It is kind of surprising. But here's the rationale. You learn to lie just when you learn to talk. And as part of that, you learn how to make your lies believable. And people in your own culture learn the same thing. It's all subconscious. And so people in your own culture are not focusing on those things that stick out that might be an indicator. But when you're looking at someone in a different culture or speaking a different language, then you notice things that look odd that you might not notice when you're speaking to someone in your own culture or seeing a video
like
of someone
cues?
In your own culture. Some of the things that they focused on, for example, were some things that we call moderators. And that's sort of a series of self-grooming behaviors where people might scratch their head or scratch their arm or adjust their clothing or adjust how they're sitting. And these things are actually pretty reliable. And you may not notice those in people in your own group, but they may stand out for people in a separate group just because even though they're the same type of behavior, they are done slightly differently from group to group.
So reliable in detecting lies is what I think you're saying. So if I'm grooming overly concerned with my grooming, I'm what, probably lying?
Well, you've hit on a very good problem with all of these indicators. Yes, moderators are very reliable. There have been some studies that have looked at data across hundreds of studies and found that moderating behavior is a very reliable indicator to deception. The only thing is, every time you scratch your head or scratch your arm or play with your hair, it doesn't mean you're lying. So the things that are indicators of deception are also indicators of just, you know, your head itches.
Right. If you just joined us, my guest is Joey George. He's a professor of management information systems at Iowa State University, also the DeVries Chair in Business at the school's College of Business. And Professor George has studied what is called computer-mediated deceptive communication for more than a decade. Professor George, so let's say I want to lie to you. Would I be better off, generally speaking, trying to do that through text communication, my cell phone maybe, or face-to-face?
Well, you've hit upon a really good question again. Theory would tell you that if you're going to try to lie to me, the best thing to do is to lie to me in an email. And that's because there's this theory that's called leakage theory, which says that when you try to lie, it's really a very difficult thing to do cognitively because not only do you have to worry about the words in the message, you have to worry about any nervousness that you might feel. You have to worry about if your voice is quivering and how to calm your nervousness. You have to worry about body language. So there's so many things that you have to worry about that some of them you're not going to do very well. And so these cues then leak to the person that you're conversing with. Well, in something like email that's basically just text, a lot of those cues aren't there. And so it would seem that in a medium like that where there are very few cues, then deception should be easier to pull off because there just aren't as many indicators possible. On the other end of the spectrum, you have traditional face-to-face communication, which is loaded with cues. So, I mean, not only do you have the words, but you have your tone of voice, you have the pitch of the voice, mm-hmm. you have all the nonverbal things that you do. And so you would think, yes, if you wanted to lie to me successfully, email would probably be the best way. Unfortunately, we're not finding those differences that theory would indicate, and we're not really quite sure why. But then again, this type of study is kind of in its infancy. There have been a few studies done dealing with media, but we're just now really starting out. So that's mm-hmm. a really good issue. We have to figure out why we're not seeing those differences in media right now.
So for people really practiced in lying, do we know what they prefer if you give them the choice?
Well, the people that are really accomplished at lying tend to be outside of our purview because they tend to have certain antisocial right. tendencies, maybe sociopathic tendencies, and so they're not very good people for us to study. But I think people that more typical people that might lie for a living or lie for fun, I think that they know pretty well what the key indicators are. And it's sort of paradoxical. Even though face-to-face is the one medium that seems to be able to give you away the most because of all the cues, it also seems to be the one that liars prefer. And we've done a couple studies where we have data on this. And again, I think it's because, one, you're used to lying that way. You know how to do it. You've done it for a long time. And two, it's more comfortable trying to control all the aspects of it. And one other thing about face-to-face is if you're lying to me face-to-face and something makes me suspicious, then I can watch you very carefully and I can start to see things that might give you away.
Right. So it's a performance and you can observe your audience, so to speak.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
And you can see how the joke or the deception is going over.
Exactly.
Why is the U.S. Air Force interested in this, interested enough to fund these studies?
Well, let's see. I think I can tell you without giving away state secrets.
Okay.
I don't have any type of clearance or anything like
right.
that. I'm just kidding. Back when they first put out a call for proposals, and this was back in the early part of the decade, they were very concerned about email. It turns out that the armed forces use quite a bit of email, and they were concerned that there might be situations where the email from a commander to someone in the field, for example, might be hijacked. And then it would be up to the people in the field to either follow the orders or try to figure out what was wrong if they suspected something and try to figure out what that problem would be if there really was something wrong. And so out of that concern for email and its vulnerabilities, they asked for some proposals to look into computer-mediated deception.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking, having watched Jack Bauer in 24 a number of times, that this would be really good if we could sort of send machines to SICM to find, with software, detect lies within emails. Wouldn't that be great?
It would be great. And in fact, that was one of the very early things that we looked at trying to do. Maybe for some older listeners, they'll remember an email package called Eudora.
Absolutely.
One thing about Eudora is that it had a little built-in feature that would watch your language for you. And so if you had some interesting language in your emails, you might get a pop-up that said, hey, this language might be considered offensive. And you could get anywhere from 1 to 3 chili peppers in that pop-up so you could edit it. We thought that would be a good model for very simple deception in email because there are some grammatical patterns. For example, a lot of passive voice, a lot of negative words, don'ts, nots, isn'ts, and also distancing between the person that's writing and the actions they're describing. And so these things would be pretty simple for a filter system like that to pick up and warn you. It turned out that in this project, which involved a lot of universities and a lot of researchers, one group actually did sort of pursue that aspect of it and started dealing with training neural networks to detect deception in text messages, again, largely based on linguistic features. And I think they actually ended up doing pretty well, but I don't know that it ever got to the point where it was ready for prime time.
Okay. To back up a little bit and get to more of a foundation of lying, how often do we lie? Do normal, let's say healthy people lie?
I know the answer to that. We did some research ourselves to follow up on a couple of diary studies that had looked at just that question. And the reason I mentioned the method is because I think it's an interesting way to study this. We essentially gave people a way to record their conversations and their deceptive behavior. Earlier studies used paper and pencil. We actually used PDAs. And so people were given the instruments and they were asked to record their communication and deception behavior for a week. And then they came back with their logs and we looked through that. And basically across all of the paper and pencil studies and our study as well, the numbers are about the same. People tend to lie on average about 20 to 25% of the time on any given day.
Wow. And that's normal. That's average.
That's normal. And well, and so then the next question is, well, what are they doing? What kind of lies are they?
What are we lying about, right?
Most of them tend to be pretty trivial and pretty altruistic. And the example that I like to give is, let's say that a colleague or a friend gets a haircut and it's really awful. And you know it's awful and everybody knows it's awful, but your friend or your colleague asks you, well, what do you think of this new haircut? I just paid $150 for this. Isn't this great? Don't I look good? And your answer is going to be,
oh, sure.
Wow, that is great. Stunning. That's really – exactly. Money well spent. So clearly you're lying, but it's to not hurt the feelings of your friend or colleague.
And so our white lies, right? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So most of that 20-25% are that type.
And you as a professor at Iowa State University, did you teach courses that involve lying, deception? Not you, but what we've been talking about.
Not solely. I mean, you can certainly work it in certain situations. For example, I'm teaching a class right now on e-commerce. And, of course, that's a danger in e-commerce is whether or not the potential sellers that you're dealing with are being honest with you. Mm-hmm. So you can work it in topics like that, but not a class just on this topic, no. Mm-hmm.
Doesn't this the advancement in this area, computer-mediated deceptive communication, the detection of it, have a huge market potential? I mean, we mentioned the Air Force, but wouldn't that be great for any company, an online company especially?
Well, I haven't cashed in yet. I think you're right. I mean, there's definitely potential. I guess the issue is that it's not 100% foolproof. I mean, the best we can do is come up with, identifying the indicators and building some foundation around those. But like I said before, just because you scratch your head doesn't mean that you're lying. So,
right. Is there anything in this research that you've looked at, been busy with for over a decade that you can tell us to use in our daily lives more or less reliably as a way to detect lying, deception?
Well, I think the situation that most people come into contact with on a daily basis has to do with things like the phishing scam, phishing. And essentially those are things that those are messages you get in email that are intentionally designed to deceive you. And fortunately, something like 97% of the public let those go. But there's still enough people that still click on them to make problems. And what I mean by that is, I guess the most famous one is the Nigerian prince scandal or scam.
I've made a lot of money from him.
there's money to be made. And of course, others are when you get an email from a bank or your bank and it says, please send us all your account information or we're going to close your account, including your password. And other things that say, oh, please click on this link or click on this attachment. And I just got one this week, in fact, from Wells Fargo, ostensibly, saying that they're going to give me $50 if I would click on this link and involve myself in a survey that they were doing. Yeah. So the best advice for your listeners is, things like that, if they seem silly or they seem too good to be true, or it's unsolicited, somebody soliciting information that seems to be your bank, just don't deal with it. Ignore it, delete it, and move on.
I'm wondering, Professor George, if there was an instance earlier in your life that that prompted you to begin looking at this field of study that made you especially interested in it.
Well, I don't have any dramatic childhood stories, no, that would you know, it's not like my mother lied to me and anything like that that I know of.
a schoolmate who really pulled the wool over your eyes and you've never forgotten it. No, not that.
No. Unfortunately, it's something much less dramatic. I had a doctoral student in one of my seminars who was from the communication discipline and brought to my attention this whole field and showed how it could be applicable to some of the research we were doing at the time on collaboration. And it was really interesting, and that's been almost 20 years since that happened. And so I got more and more interested in it and slowly got more and more involved, and then I was fortunate to be able to be part of this big project early in the decade. So
looking forward, you've studied this for many years, and you said it's an undeveloped field, a lot yet to discover here. If you could tell us two or three burning questions that you would love to know the answers to, what would those be?
Well, there are definitely some areas that are under-researched, and there's some things that we've dabbled in that I would like to continue work on. One that we haven't really talked about is groups. Most of this research, again, has focused on one-to-one communication, but there's no reason to think that people that work in groups, that are on teams, that are collaborating with each other, there's no reason to think that they're not lying to multiple people as part of that collaboration. People have competing goals in the workplace, and sometimes they have to resort to deception or half-truths in order to, keep pursuing those goals and pursuing some at the expense of others. And there's been research in the management area that's found that that certainly happens, and we just don't know much about that at all. How do people in the group determine if somebody else is lying to them? One thing in one-on-one conversation is you really only have your own experience and your own wits to try to figure out what's going on. But in a group, you can actually communicate with other people and try to figure out if somebody's being deceptive or not. And I think that's a desperately under-researched area. And the other one, of course, gets back to culture, which we had talked about earlier. That's an area where there's more and more research, some great research, but in terms of crossing culture and computer-mediated communication and deception, again, that's something that's brand new.
With all this new technology and it's racing forward, all these new means of communicating, are we becoming better liars as this technology advances?
Over computer-mediated communication modes?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's inevitable.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had hundreds of thousands of years to deal with lying verbally. We've only had a couple of decades of dealing with it in email and instant messaging and cell phone text messaging. So, and we're pretty quick learners. So, yeah, I think inevitably we'll become just as good at lying over any communication mode as we are face-to-face.
Ben Kiefer's conversation with Iowa State University Professor of Management Information Systems, Joey George. George has studied computer-mediated deceptive communication for the past decade. Coming up next, the economics of patents and inventions. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today, you're listening to an encore edition of the program. The Ames Laboratory is a research facility of the U.S. Department of Energy. It's owned by the government, but it's run by Iowa State University. Through a contract with the government, ISU retains rights to the intellectual property, such as patents, developed there at the Ames Lab. One of their most successful patents to date is for an environmentally friendly lead-free solder. It's an invention that in the last 15 years has earned Iowa State University nearly
$40 million in royalties. In 2011, this solder patent became the top royalty income-generating technology ever produced in the history of both the Ames Lab and Iowa State University. My guest for the remainder of the hour is Ivor Anderson. He's a senior metallurgist at the Ames Lab. He led the team in developing the lead-free solder. Ivor Anderson, welcome back to our program.
Oh, thank you very much, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here.
And congratulations on that landmark of doing that with this patent. Tell us, to begin with, what qualities does solder have that makes it so useful?
Well, I think that anyone who has ever used hand soldering iron to put together an electrical joint knows that you want your solder to melt at a fairly low temperature, so it doesn't require much heat, because heat can damage electrical components on either end of the solder joint. And also you want your solder to wet. There's a phrase called wetting, which means just literally that the molten solder alloy must be able to intimately join to the conductor on each side, usually copper.
Mm-hmm. So that it doesn't break away from it, the surface, you mean, that it kind of really holds on.
That's correct. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right.
And originally the solder contained lead, or still contains lead, some solder. And lead is a problem if it's in electronics. Why?
Well, the key problem was recognized fairly early on, back in the 90s, actually, by the Japanese first, because their communities are very closely spaced, and their people live in right on top of each other, you could say. But they have landfill sites that are very closely contiguous with residential areas and with schools and things like that. And the landfill leaching of lead from discarded electronic components is really what they recognize as a problem environmentally.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to look at the history of this patent, that the patent for this invention was granted way back in 1996, but it was a few years before this took hold, before there was a great market for it. Tell us why.
Well, that's an interesting case where actually regulation, environmental regulation, drives innovation. And the Japanese early on had a commercial emphasis in their electronics industry on going lead-free so that they could get the marketing advantage of a green leaf sticker. But the Europeans chose the regulation approach, and the European Union, the Parliament, adopted what is a key landmark piece of environmental legislation, and it has to do with outlawing the manufacturing or sale of goods that have a certain, there's a list of 16 toxic metals and chemicals. And it was July 1st of 2006 when that regulation went into effect. Mm-hmm. And that was a key driver for essentially pulling in environmentally sound materials into the manufacturing arena.
So when we look at all of the devices that we have out there, and they're growing in number and quantity every year, give us some examples of where we might find this lead-free solder.
Oh, that's very interesting. Our lab director, Alex King, likes to say that half the world's population actually uses our lead-free solder, or more than half, whatever the estimates are, of cell phone users. Cell phones actually were the first electronic package to have lead-free solder in them. Mm-hmm. And the discarding of cell phones is a huge problem every year. In this country, I believe the statistic now might be 20 million cell phones are discarded every year. You know, think of how many times you know, your kids might say, "I would like to get a new cell phone."
Right? Is there such a thing as a market share that you know of all the things that are soldered in this world? How many are done with your patented lead-free solder?
Yes, actually, there is a survey that's done by the European Union, and right now I believe, in the electronics manufacturing, electronics assembly industry. It's 70. It's approaching 70% of the soldering applications are done with lead-free solder.
Mm. And of those that are done with lead-free solder, are there alternatives to your product, your patent?
Yes, there are.
Okay, so it's not all. You don't have that 70%.
No.
Okay.
That's a huge number. And there are different soldering techniques. And our solder is especially good for what's called surface mount technology, which is where electronic components are mounted on the surface of a printed wiring board with a paste. So our solder alloy is made into a paste.
Would it be safe to say that everyone listening has an electronic device that has your patented lead-free solder in it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Without doubt, huh?
I think so.
Okay. When you set out to do this, was the idea to get a green technology there? Did you set out, or did this come, as sometimes in inventions, by happenstance? It just happened to pop out of the woodwork, and lo and behold, it has a great use.
We were pursuing a lead-free solder, no question about it. We wanted to try to emulate the properties of the beautiful properties, actually, of tin lead solder and emulate those without the lead. So it was very specifically a search for a lead-free solder.
And was there a lot of frustration in that search? Was it hard to do?
Oh, yes. These are the kinds of things that certainly drive graduate students and advisors crazy. Everybody says it's impossible at the beginning. My old thesis advisor actually had told me that the approach that we were using was not going to work, and that's always a gratifying thing.
and so the search started in what year? The patent granted in 96. The search started when?
It started in 1992.
Okay, so a few years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh yeah, we had some nice. Funding from Department of Energy, Basic Energy Sciences, that let us explore a lot of different types of systems, actually. And we looked at some of the components that we thought should go into a lead-free solder that would be widely available, and copper and silver are quite widely used in electronics industry already. And we know that the prices of those two components, even the price of silver right now, people think is quite high. But if you're using it as a small alloy component, it's really not that bad.
If you just joined us, my guest this half hour is Ivor Anderson, a senior metallurgist at the Ames Laboratory at Iowa State University, talking about his lab's research in solder. 15 years ago, an environmentally friendly solder developed by the U.S. Department of Energy's Ames Laboratory made history as the first cost-effective, broadly usable alternative to tin lead solder, which of course is toxic, and it has proliferated now, this lead-free solder, in consumer electronics in 2011, becoming the top royalty income-generating technology ever produced in the history of both the Ames Lab and Iowa State University. Nearly $40 million to date. Where has all that royalty money gone? What's it been used for?
Well, actually, the university here has a very good policy for how the royalties are divided. And a great thing that they do is the Research Foundation, Iowa State University Research Foundation, takes a lot of the royalty funds that they bring in and puts it out for the use of researchers here at the university. Mm-hmm. I've gotten in that kind of research funding approaching $400,000 for running experiments, and including further solder developments and other things as well.
So in this time of budgetary strain, the Ames Laboratory is on solid financial footing, we could say.
Yes, you could. That's a nice thing.
Now, I wonder, because we're dealing with intellectual property here, are all countries and manufacturers that you know of respecting this intellectual property rights in this case, or do you have people figuring out how you did it and then taking a detour around paying those royalties?
Yeah, that's called reverse engineering. But I can tell you that it is very gratifying to see the different countries now, the companies from different countries signing up. I mean, it used to be the case, and you often hear this on the news, that the Chinese government, the mainland Chinese government, is, you know, they all say that they don't respect intellectual property. Well, right now, I can tell you that in the last couple of years, companies from mainland China have been some of the most recent licensees.
Mm-hmm. How long does this patent last? How many years of royalties are left?
I'm thinking it's 2 years. It's between 2 and 3 years.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that there are many different types of solders, many different types of lead-free solders. Are there any drawbacks to using this particular type of lead-free solder compared with a traditional lead solder?
Yes. I mean, and actually these are some research topics that we've been working on. One of the things is that leaded solder, the tin lead eutectic solder that's was very widely used in electronics, regardless of the size of the solder joint, whether it is on the order of microns, which, you know, millionths of a meter, or whether it's on the order of several millimeters, you know, approaching basically an eighth of an inch or something like that. Regardless of the size of the joint, the microstructure and therefore the properties of that solder joint were very, very consistent. Now, our solder, which is primarily tin-based, it's 93% tin as opposed to only basically 67% tin. That domination of tin and the small additions of copper and silver, when that alloy, even though it was a single melting alloy, when that eutectic alloy solidifies, it has a variety of different microstructures, some of them brittle, actually. And we've been working for the last several years on developing a fourth addition into our tin, silver, copper to control the solidification structure so that you could always depend on those properties being ductile and strong.
So you're working on overcoming these flaws in this to make a higher performing product.
That's right. That's right. Higher reliability.
Higher reliability. I understand that with solder, because our electronic devices go everywhere in all kinds of temperatures, especially in military applications, it has to be able to withstand incredible hot and cold fluctuations.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thermal cycling is a key benchmark especially for military applications. And here, actually, I've been blessed, I think, by having Rockwell Collins located not too far down the road from us, and an ISU alum there that is a very good friend of mine. And Dave Hillman and I have done a lot of experiments together, and just within the last year or two, we've done some 2,000, 3,000 cycles, thermal cycles of minus 55 degrees C to plus 125 degrees C in the period of about an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. And when you do that kind of thermal cycle, that is replicating what it takes to take an aircraft up to a high altitude and come back down. Coming back down in Phoenix, I suppose, something like that. The military spec is actually 2,000 cycles, and we took our joints up to 3,000 cycles, and we had a very nice behavior. Essentially, everything that the joints that needed to stay whole stayed whole without cracking.
Mm-hmm. Without getting too, out of our range of understanding, if we're not specialists in this area, how does that hot and cold cycling change the molecular structure there to make it perhaps not what it was when it was new?
Well, it has to do with thermal expansion, actually. And a lot of times military hardware and commercial hardware, there is a ceramic surface that has all kinds of electronic circuits on it, and that is being joined to a composite epoxy board, and that board then has all the outside electrical contacts. But the gap between the two, the ceramic and the fiberglass, basically, there's a big difference in thermal expansion. The ceramic is much less prone to expansion when it heats up. So you get a mismatch, you could say, in the dimensions of the solder between the top and the bottom of the joint.
Ivor Anderson, we have a few minutes left, and last time you were on, we talked about your work in developing alternatives to rare earth permanent magnets. Neodymium was one of the types that we were talking about. Remind us why that's important quickly, and if you can tell if anything's new on that front in your research.
Oh, sure. Yes, actually, it's becoming more important right now. The Chinese have announced that their export quotas are going to essentially continue to go down.
Mm-hmm. And this is where we get most of our rare earth permanent magnets.
That's right. Actually, the figure is something like 98% right now.
Yeah.
We do have some progress that we are being we are able to make, and we're going to be doing in the next 2 and 3 months here. I have a new graduate student who's going to be working on seeing exactly how far we can push an old type of rare earth free magnet called Alnico. We're going to see how far we can push the microstructure of that to get a lot more permanent magnet strength out of that.
And remind us again where we find rare earth magnets. On our person, on our devices again, right?
Oh, sure. Actually, the microphone that you're using right now and I'm using have magnets in them, as well as these headphones, your cell phone. And if you have a hybrid car, and that's actually our research funding is basically going to that kind of application where you need very strong magnets. Your hybrid car is run by an electric motor that has neodymium iron boron magnets in it.
I understand your lab is also trying to develop a high-temperature version of stainless steel for use in nuclear reactors, coal-fired power plants.
Exactly, yes. I had a graduate student just finish his PhD, Joel Reakin. And he and I have been working on a very efficient way to make these rare earth oxide reinforced stainless steels. And we can essentially, 10% of the cost. That's our rough estimate, actually, of what we could probably transfer this technology to the steel industry, and they could be doing it.
Mm-hmm. Here's sort of a kitchen question that I've wondered about, and you may be the specialist to answer it. I didn't know until fairly recently that nonstick coatings on most pans don't do well when you really heat them up a lot, continually. You destroy the nonstick coating.
That's right. Yeah, that's Teflon.
that's Teflon. It seems if someone could make a better nonstick coating, that would be a big deal, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes. Actually, there was a lot of excitement in our lab several years ago when a type of alloy called a quasi-crystal was developed. And actually, this is what Danny Scheckman won his Nobel Prize for, was quasi-crystals. But we were atomizing, processing into powder, actually, the aluminum, copper, iron quasi-crystals. And working with a French lab on developing non-stick cookware coatings, mm-hmm. believe it or not, which you could actually use a steel flipper in your for flipping your eggs.
Never worry about scratching it or getting those particles in your food?
That's right. Well, the key thing was you had to have a thermal spray device that was good enough so that you would you would fasten every one of those particles down to that coating.
Mm-hmm. We have just a minute or so left. Here's an offbeat question. Going back to your non-lead solder, maybe you don't know this, but I would have to think that someone at the lab has thought about this. Why is solder spelled the way it is with a silent L?
That's a great question. I'll have to put my linguistic friends on that one. I do not know.
Okay. Well, maybe you can do it over lunch and have salmon for lunch while you're talking about that question.
Good point, Ben.
Okay, Ivor Anderson, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, a senior metallurgist at the Ames Lab. Ivor led the team in developing lead-free solder. In 2011, it became the top royalty income-generating technology ever produced in the history of both the Ames Lab and Iowa State University. And Ivor Anderson, I look forward to the next time you can talk to us about metals. Always fascinating.
Very good. I've enjoyed myself a lot here, Ben.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Technical support from Dennis Reese. And remember, podcasts and on-demand audio of River to River available by going to iowapublicradio.org. And we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime at this email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.